Outside the Pulpit, episode 3, take 1, Mark.
So you grew up in a Christian home, right, Brother Shelley?
Yeah, I mean, both my parents were Christian. They actually met in New York. That's where I was born. And they were actually raised Assemblies of God, but I never really was raised in an Assemblies of God church. When I was pretty young, we moved to the Dallas-Fort Worth area, and they took us to just a really big non-denominational, you know, church, kind of a fun center type of a church. And, you know, the one thing that I can say about that movement that I liked is the preachers were actually pretty hard in their preaching. They preach really with a lot of animation, a lot of zeal.
So they weren't really preaching a lot of doctrine, but they would kind of preach hard against sin sometimes? Is that
Yeah, I mean, they're preaching that we should be sold out for the Lord and we should, you know, get sin out of our lives. And, you know, they wouldn't hit on touchy subjects, that's for sure.
Right.
But they were definitely preaching, you know, feel-good messages and inspiring, uplifting messages. And I would always go to the Sunday school. And in the Sunday school area, they always gave the invitation to be saved. They were always preaching, you know, we need to believe in the Lord Jesus Christ, his death, burial, and resurrection. And as a very young age, at 5, I came down and I prayed and I accepted Christ as my Savior. And the interesting thing about that day is that same day when I went back home, I actually lived adjacent. The back yard was connected to our neighbors behind us. And so it was just a fence between us. And these two twins are about my same age. They live right behind me. And so we played every single day. And I was over in their house, and I was jumping on the trampoline, and I was, like, compelled. I was like, I need to tell these guys, you know, about the gospel. I need to get these guys saved.
Right.
And so I just started preaching to them, like, hey, you know, we all deserve hell, and we need to believe on the Lord Jesus Christ, or we're going to go to hell when we die. And I ended up getting one of the twins there to, you know, agree he needed to be saved, and I ended up praying with him. And the other twin, he was kind of skeptical of what we were saying. And I don't feel like I was necessarily completely in the spirit there, because then we started making fun of him, like, hey, you're going to go to hell, we're going to heaven. But then we ended up actually convincing him that he needed to be saved too. But that's kind of like the only real step I had into evangelism at that age. I definitely felt like I had a zeal of God, but not really according to knowledge.
So your next soul winning was not for a long time that
you attempted to get
someone the gospel?
Not even close. I don't even know what I said, you know, back then. I'm sure it was pretty weak, but I raised, you know, pretty much a normal childhood, raised in a regular home. We went to church every Sunday morning. We didn't go to church in the midweek service or in the afternoon. The churches we went to, they'd have multiple services, but the services were the exact same sermon.
Right.
So
you pick one.
Basically. Right. Yeah. They'd have thousands of people, and so it enabled to accommodate them in the building. You know, they have to have multiple services just to be able to fit everybody in.
Right.
They can't have that one service. And so I went to public school most of my life. Actually, when we moved from the Dallas-Fort Worth area to the Amarillo area when I was in the second grade, my parents actually put me in private Christian school. So we were going to a large non-denominational church there, but they had a private Christian school. And I went there for the last part of the second grade. And you know, I really didn't like it. It wasn't, I felt from an education standpoint that I wasn't learning anything. And I felt like from a Christian perspective that it was just kind of going through the motions. It was just like a ritual. Nobody really even believed it. And most of the kids that even went to that private school, I never saw them in church. I never saw them in the youth group. And they were kind of like in their own little group. So I didn't really fit in. They didn't really want, you know, outsiders to be part of their group.
So you went back to public school?
Yeah, I told my parents, like, they gave me the option. They kind of said, hey, do you like going to this school or do you want to go back to regular school? And I was like, yeah, I wholeheartedly want to go back to public school.
You got pretty into sports, right?
Yeah, I mean, I really liked sports a lot. I played soccer when I was young for a long period of time. And then I even got into roller hockey. So I kind of played roller hockey. I was on a traveling team and I got to play some of that. And then by the time I was 14... and going into high school, you kind of had to pick what sport you were going to play. And I ended up making the transition to golf. And my dad, through the summer, when he would go to work, he would just take me to the golf course and drop me off in the morning, and then he'd pick me up after work. So like 7:30 in the morning, I'm dropped off at the golf course by myself, and then like at 5:30 after work.
So you just play golf for like 8 hours a day?
Yeah, 8 or 9 hours. I mean, I'd take like a 30-minute lunch break or something.
That's crazy.
So I would just practice for a few hours. I'd play 2 rounds of golf every single day.
I have a hard time just making it through the 18 holes of mini golf. Like that, you know, by the end of that, I'm ready to go home.
I mean, I'm constantly just trying to like make up, you know, all kinds of weird games to like play, you know, because I was always playing by myself, and the only people on the golf course.
Oh, you weren't even playing with other people?
No, I mean, the only other people on the golf course are like the 70 and 80 year old retired guys that are just out there just because they have nothing else to do with their life. So they're just out there. I mean, you know, I'm just basically by myself just playing. You know, luckily they had a lot of tournaments in the summer, so that would kind of break up the monotony of just going by myself every day. So I get to play in a lot of golf tournaments, but.
Yeah, I've never played real golf before, only mini golf. And did you meet your wife in high school too, right?
Yeah, kind of in our junior year, she actually started liking me, but she was nervous because she was taller than me, so she wasn't sure how she felt about her feelings, but I didn't even know this. And then we ended up having a bunch of classes together our senior year because I did the show choir and the chorale, and she was always in the choir and that type of stuff. We were both into the high school musical, and she was the female lead, and I was like the second male lead. But our characters had this kissing scene that was in the musical, and we, in the practices, finally our director just says, all right, no more fake kissing, we have to do the real thing, we have to practice for real. And so it's supposed to be just kind of an innocent, like, little peck or something like that. But there was a lot of pressure, you know, from all the guys. They're like, oh, you got to lay one on her, you know. And in the scene, my wife's character, she's supposed to be the one that's supposed to be aggressive and, like, kind of approaching me. But I was just kind of nervous about the whole thing. And so when I came out on stage, I just kind of, like, went right up to her and I just laid one right on her.
Just go big or go home,
yeah.
Huh?
I mean, we weren't even dating or anything. We didn't even say that we liked each other, but I just kind of laid one on her, and she just, like, pushed me away and was like, ew, gross, and, like, kicked me in the shin with her, like, boot. And it was kind of this big deal.
She loved it.
Yeah, that's what everybody said. They were like, Jonathan kissed her, and she liked it. And
She was just putting on a show because she was embarrassed.
Yeah.
Does she admit it now or no?
No, she acts like she didn't like it back then, but I don't know. A few months later, we started dating, so.
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, our first date, we had a show choir gig, and we actually sang in a Mormon church. So we had a gig in a Mormon church. It was really creepy. But right after, I was like, hey, you want to go to dinner? So we went to dinner, and then we just started dating.
So that was the first date?
Yeah, we went to, like, Olive Garden.
Oh, okay.
And she ordered something off the kids' menu. But, no, we started dating, and we were pretty serious, but I had this idea in my mind, like, you don't get married until after college. So we dated for a very long time. We dated for like 5 years. And then right after we graduated college is when we ended up getting married.
So you graduated from college, you got married, and what did you study in college and what field did you go into?
Yeah, so it was a big day because I had just gotten married and then I started my first job and I basically quit playing golf. So I'd studied business management. And that's a worthless degree. I don't recommend anybody getting that degree. It basically gave me no skills.
So you don't think it's going to help you pastor?
Well, you know, maybe. I think all things work together for good.
Right.
There's a lot of things that you can gain from any experience in college just as far as just general education or life lessons. But as far as having applicable skills to the workforce, I had nothing.
Oh, okay.
So I just started working for Wells Fargo Bank. That was the only thing I could find
in
was working
branch?
For a bank. Yeah, I was a personal banker.
Oh, okay.
So I did like sales and that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And I hated it. I mean, that place was one of the most fake places that I've ever worked for. Because everybody that you walk in, they smile and they're real happy.
Right.
But they're constantly judged by all these surveys that are taken by the clients, by the customers. Mm-hmm. And if you ever get a non-perfect survey, then you get reprimanded by your manager. So they have to give you all fives in every single category or you basically lose your job. So that's why everybody's just, like, going out of their way to just make it, like, you're their favorite person and they know everything about you.
Yeah, but, you know, some people just give you a four anyway. Because have you ever seen when you're going on Google and you're looking at the reviews, you'll see these stupid comments where people are like, this is the best restaurant I've ever had. I love it so much. 4 stars. And you're just like, what's a 5-star?
Exactly. This is what I brought to my manager because I got surveyed the most. Yeah. I got surveyed like 10 times. Uh-huh. And I had 2 surveys that weren't perfect. And one was like, you know, a 4 snuck in there.
Yeah, right.
And I said, some people just don't want to give 5 stars.
There are
and
people like that.
She was like, it just sounds like you don't want to, you know, learn from your mistakes and you can't admit. And I was like, no, if I, you know, make a mistake, I want to fix it and I want to do better. And I know I'm not perfect. But I said, it seems like the bar is a little high there.
You know? Right.
But the thing that really turned me off about it is the overdraft fees. So,
oh, man. It's crazy.
The way they did banking there is all of your items that were pending on the weekend, they charged the highest items first,
right,
even though it wasn't in chronological order.
Yep.
So people would have their mortgage coming in over the weekend, and they would charge that first. And these people are going to, like, get a dollar Coke and $2, you know, candy bar throughout the weekend.
And they're paying, like, $30 for each $1.50 item that they overdrafted or whatever.
Yeah, so they reverse the order. So their mortgage comes through for, like, $1,000, and it would overdraft their account by, like, $50.
Yep.
And instead of just getting one overdraft fee, because Wells Fargo would say, well, we're going to move that to the first item, all these $1 items got a $35 fee each.
Yeah.
So these people are living paycheck to paycheck. They barely make very much money.
And they're just getting demolished.
Like $500 or $600 in fees.
Yeah.
And we used two systems, and the old system allowed the personal bankers to kind of go in and reverse the fees, even though we weren't supposed to.
Right.
Exactly. And but you'd have these customers come in, they're crying, they don't have any money.
Yeah.
So this one guy reversed like half of his fees.
Yeah.
And he should have only gotten charged one.
Yeah.
By the way, the system, you know, the chronological order. And I just felt like a really wicked person, you know, even just charging him half of the fees. But then we got in trouble with all of our managers because...
Because you did that.
The store has to meet a 92% collection ratio on all overdraft fees.
Oh, wow.
For the managers to get their bonus.
Oh,
so these managers get these like tens of thousands of dollars of bonuses every quarter based on their overdraft collection rate.
Yeah.
And so if they don't meet a specific ratio, then they don't get paid out.
I made that mistake one time. Early in my marriage, there was one time when I overdrew my account. And it was like that, where it was like five transactions or whatever, where they did that, the little moving things around. So I got hit with like $175 of fees or something, and it was horrible. And I got him to take half of it off. You know, I probably got that guy in trouble.
Yeah.
But I got him to take half the fees off. But ever since then, I've just made it a rule to keep a buffer in my account. And I recommend to people that they should never, ever run their account down below $100 or $200. Because sometimes you just forget about one or two transactions and you're just not paying attention or whatever. So from that day on, when I made that mistake, I started just keeping a $500 buffer, meaning that I considered $500 the zero.
Exactly.
And just never go below. And then you know, when you get to where you have more kids and you're spending more money, you got to have a $1,000 buffer, $2,000 buffer. But, I mean, when I see people running their checking account down to, like, $8, $15, it's madness. Because you're going to slip up. And when you slip up, it's just, they're going to come down on you like a ton of bricks, and they have no mercy.
Yeah, you write a check, and someone takes a week to cash it, and you just forget that you wrote that check.
About it. Or, yeah.
I mean, and the thing is even people that were financially responsible or made a lot of money would fall into this trap. I was trying to find all kinds of inventive ways to get people sales. And we had to do all these door-to-door sales. It's kind of like soul winning, but not like soul winning.
Yeah, and, except you're like hurting people.
Right, you're trying to you take all their money. I looked through this report and I tried to find the biggest offenders in overdraft fees. And there were people that were paying tens of thousands of dollars a year in overdraft fees.
That's crazy.
And I found this couple, they were both like one was a doctor and one was like a lawyer. So they're bringing in like $10,000,
$15,000. They just didn't think about money. So they're just blowing money and not thinking about it.
They would spend like $6,000 or $7,000 in the negative every single month. And they would just rack up like thousands of dollars of overdraft fees every month. I mean, they literally had $40,000 or $50,000 in overdraft fees in one year that they paid.
That's insane.
And I took it to my managers and I was like really proud that I found it. Because I was thinking like, hey, this is a great person. We need to call them and tell them like, hey, you need to figure it out. What's going on with your account? Because you're paying all these fees.
And he's like, no, we love this guy.
Exactly. They said, do not call them. They said, if you call them, then we're going to lose your job.
Yeah, they didn't want you to counsel with that person and help them like not go in the negative because they want you in the negative.
Exactly.
That's why, like, whenever it's possible with your bank, sometimes you can tell your bank, like, if I don't have enough money, don't let the transaction go through. Because what they would do if they were honest is that if I don't have money in my account and I swipe my card, it should just say declined.
Yeah.
Instead of letting me buy that stick of gum and pay $35 for it, right?
And you have no idea.
Yeah. It should just tell you declined. And then it's like, oh, I don't have any money. But they'll just let you just keep on going. They'll just let you keep on going because they're just like...
Well, and even if they don't collect it from you, they just sell it to a collection agency for 50 cents on the dollar, even though it's all just plain
money. Well, it's a good lesson for pastoring the church, too, to always keep a buffer of money in the bank. Because we are at Faithful Word, and when you're turning over a lot of money, you got to have a big buffer. Because it's not worth it. You'd rather just have extra money in the account, one overdraft fee, and it multiplies and compounds. It's just, it's not worth it.
So, you know, I only worked there for a few months. I really couldn't stand it. And I ended up working for another bank, which was, but I worked in a different department. I didn't do sales. I did like credit analyst work. But I really wasn't happy. And I ended up deciding I needed to make a career change. And I don't know exactly why, but I realized that my position had no tangible skills. And that if I were ever to move, I'd be like starting over in my career.
Yeah.
And so I thought, I need to get a job where no matter where I move or no matter what I do, I could have a good paying job.
Yeah.
That it was more skill dependent. So I ended up going back to get a master's degree. And I was getting it in finance and economics. And man, I just did not like economics at all. It's studying all these failed, you know, philosophical viewpoints.
Did you read Wealth of Nations by Adam Smith?
Yeah. So you have to read all the, you read all these Keynesian economic models and all these things. And they're all failed plans. But I ended up considering computer programming as well. And we were going to a life group, me and my wife. And so one of the guys that was there, he said, hey, if you really want to, you can come work for us. So I had no experience, no ability to do any programming, and they just brought me on and basically taught me how to do computer
programming. So that's how you got into computer programming.
Yeah.
See, I just assumed when you said you were a computer programmer that you must have studied that in college.
Nope, didn't study it at all. I didn't know anything.
Yeah, because Pastor Dave Berzins, he went to college for computer programming, and that's what he does. So you actually just got on-the-job training.
Yeah, I had this. I had a lot of pressure because I felt like I had to make a certain amount of money in order to afford kids.
Mm-hmm.
And we hadn't had any children yet.
Right.
And so I knew that we were wanting to have kids, and I was like, I need to have a better job. So that's kind of the motivation to even really look for a different job. And then we ended up having our first son, Clayton. You know, we went through the traditional hospital route with Clayton, and she ended up getting induced. And, you know, it was kind of a bad experience because she ended up getting the epidural.
Mm-hmm.
And since she couldn't feel it, you know, she ended up going into labor and was actually going to give birth to our first child. But because the doctor was not there, they made her stop. And I know that if she hadn't had the epidural at that point, that she would, it wouldn't even been possible.
You wouldn't be able to stop.
Because I saw all of Clayton's head. Yeah. Like, he was crowning.
Yeah, that's literally. So weird. And they're like, wait, we got to wait for the doctor.
So we wait 30 minutes for the doctor to show up.
Yeah.
And then she has to go back through it all again, and she ended up tearing and having,
man.
I mean, it was just this horrible experience. And so we were pretty much convinced that, you know, there was something wrong there. But we still were going to go through the hospital route with our second child.
Yeah.
But as I was listening to more of your preaching and kind of changing my mind about a lot of different things, we had already decided we wanted to do a home birth.
Mm-hmm.
But we had paid for the doctor. So
right.
We're like, okay, we'll still go to the hospital, but we're going to be, I'm going to be on top of this thing. We're not going to let this happen again. Well, we go to bed, I think it was a day before her due date, and there was nothing unusual. I just went to bed at like 11. At 1 in the morning, she wakes me up, and she comes in, and she's like, I'm having a lot of contractions. And I was like, okay, well, how far apart are they? And she was like, 30 seconds. And I was like, 30 seconds? That means you're like about to have the baby in my mind. But, you know, because we'd gone through the first route, I didn't have enough experience to really know how everything worked. And so I was like, surely she's not having contractions 30 seconds. So I called the hospital. They said, you know, put her in a bath. Put her in a cold bath or warm bath. And if it subsides, then just stay there. And if it increases, then just come right away. So I make this bath and she's getting in there. And I'm kind of running around frantically just like, preparing things, trying to get ready to go, and calling her mother-in-law, and she starts screaming, and she's just like, no, he's coming, and I was like, oh, man, so I was like, I get her clothes, and I was like, let's go, we'll get in the car right now, we'll get to the hospital, and she's like, you don't understand, he's coming right now, so I was like, okay, and so she gets on the bed, and she just starts, you know, giving birth.
Yeah.
And, like, I didn't know what was happening. She's like, call 911. And so I was like, okay. So I just call 911. I'm like, I'm thinking, what are they going to do? You know, like.
Well, send a paramedic.
Yeah, call like, the ambulance or whatever.
Yeah, the paramedic's trained in that.
I'm calling them, and they just put me on hold. So I'm on hold, and my wife is, like, giving birth to our son. Like, our water's breaking, and things are happening. And then I run to get some towels, and as soon as I come back, he's completely crowned at this point.
Yeah.
And it looked like to me that maybe the cord is kind of like wrapped around his neck.
Yeah.
So I was thinking, oh man, we got to go. Like I just kind of grab him and like one more big push. And then he just birthed there in like 8 minutes.
Wow.
Like, she's just saying, like, wakes me up in the middle of the night, and she's like, I'm contracting. And then before we know it, like, now we're giving birth in our room, on our bed, you know, to our second child. So that was just,
so the second child was an unassisted home birth.
Yeah. I mean, we were just sitting there. Not something I really recommend. Not something we had planned.
You don't want to recommend that.
But obviously, you know, it was kind of a crazy experience. At that point, I said, do we even need to go to the hospital? But we still went to the hospital. We got treatment and everything like that. And so that was how we had, you know, our second child. It's kind of a special story. You know, my mother-in-law, she walks down the hall because she was expecting to just wait there at the house with our first child while we went to the hospital. And I walked through the hall and she's like, she already had the kid. And she was like, oh, what? And then she kind of came in and we had three police officers show up. We had two paramedics show up. So it was kind of like a madhouse in our house. And we just took the ambulance, you know, up to the, up north to Amarillo. Because it was about 20 minutes away. Mm-hmm. So my wife was actually raised in a Southern Baptist church. Mm-hmm. And I was raised in this non-denominational church. But I thought it was the best church in the world. You know, I was convinced that this was, you know, where I was supposed to be and that it was really great. And I had talked to my wife and I said, you know, if you want to marry me, you know, you have to come to my church. You know, wherever I decide that I want to go to church, you have to go to that church. And I said, I'm not even interested in moving from this area because I think this church is, you know, like one of the best churches. And so she ended up coming with me to my church. But, you know, my church was far from the truth. I just didn't realize it. And I always tried to help out. I actually worked in the church nursery at that church for about 4 years.
In the nursery?
Yeah.
So they put dudes in the nursery?
Well, it was mostly women that worked in the nursery.
Right.
But they allowed a lot of the young teenagers to work in the nursery.
Okay.
And there was all these young guys that I was friends with, and they just all worked in the nursery. And like, it's so cool, man. Like, you got to work.
Animal crackers, Kool-Aid, that's it.
You know, they had big programs. So, like, I worked in the 4 and 5 year old group with these other teenage guys, and you know, we would just do all kinds of stuff. We'd play baseball in the kids' rooms, and
so there's just a lot of games and singing and fun. So for them, it was more fun than sitting in the church service, basically.
Yeah, we would just go, and we even got paid. I got paid to work in the church nursery. It was a weird experience because other than those guys, everybody else that worked in the church nursery didn't go to church. Like, they didn't even go to our church.
They just only
worked in the nursery. And they would be asking me, like, hey, do you want to get high after after we're done working?
Good night. I'm like, so it's like these people are dropping off their 4 or 5 year old with just strange teenage boys that are getting high. They're not even interested in church. Exactly. They're just there for the money, the crackers, and the party.
I mean, it was bizarre.
Wow, that's weird, man.
And even some of the women that worked there, they didn't go to our church. And this one divorcee, she had like 3 kids. She was like on the prowl on all us young guys. Like, it was weird. And I'm not joking. She was like 33, you know, or something like that. I think her husband was like in jail or something and they'd been divorced. Well, she
sounds like who I want to drop my 5-year-old off with.
She ended up convincing one of the young guys. They ended up getting married when he turned 18.
No way.
Not joking. Like, she was constantly on the prowl on all the guys. It was such a weird thing.
And you're telling your wife, like, this is a great church. You know, you gotta come to my church.
Yeah,
this makes the Southern Baptists look a little better, huh?
Yeah. Obviously, that's an issue. I never blame, like, the leadership for that, for some reason.
Well, because when that's all you know, you probably just thought it was just how things are.
Yeah, I thought they must not know this. So after that, you know, I started working in the youth group. I really liked working with young people. I felt like they did a lot of fun stuff.
Right.
But the youth programs were very hot and cold. They would kind of gear up and a bunch of people would come and then all of a sudden they would die down because the main pastor would be doing something he shouldn't be doing or something weird. And I even went to the Sunday morning service and was helping with the youth group. And the main guy, he wasn't there a lot of the weeks. So the second guy was in charge. And instead of actually preaching, he would just show videos. He would just show like a YouTube clip or something. And this one week, he decides to show this YouTube clip, and I'd never heard this guy. He shows this YouTube clip of Rob Bell, and I'd never heard of this guy. He wrote this book called Love Wins.
Yeah, he's a total
fag. And so he promotes this, like, video about how, you know, you've heard that it's been said that you have to believe in Jesus or go to hell, but if that's true, then God's not really loving, and obviously that's not the God of the Bible.
And they play this in your church?
Yeah. They didn't preach. They're just playing this video.
That's what he's famous for, is like saying that everybody's saved and there's nobody's going to hell.
Love wins.
Love wins and all that, yeah.
So I'm sitting here blown away because I'm like highly offended. I was just like, "What? This is like contrary to everything about the Bible."
Yeah, cross.
I was offended even if it was a good video. Mm. Like, I already didn't like it. And so I was kind of getting frustrated with the youth group, but then they just shut it down. And they just was like, well, this guy is going to move, or something worked out. So they just had no youth group. Then they had another guy come in, and I started getting involved again, and they did life groups for the kids. And so I was like, well, I'll just, you know, do a life group. So I ended up having what they did, a basketball group. Because all the life groups, you had to have this, like, edgy,
like a
cool
theme.
Topic. Yeah. Yeah. So we went to, they had a big gym, and we would just play basketball, and I did, like, a 20-minute sermon. Mm. You know, maybe in the middle of the group or something like
right.
that. And in this process, you know, kind of through this process, I was really becoming more and more zealous and more wanting to study the Bible and actually know what I believed. Mm. And so I was kind of researching a lot of different things. I ended up finding online a debate between Ken Ham and Bill Nye. Mm. And I'd kind of like made it up in my mind, like, this is going to be a big debate. Like, everybody's going to watch
this
thing.
Didn't this just happen just a few years ago?
It happened in 2014, February of 2014.
Right. Yeah.
But they had been announcing it for like a year. Like, they put out their first billboards and all these things.
So I actually watched it.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay. So like in 2013, I was like studying. I was like, who's this Ken Ham guy? I've never heard of him. I was like, I hope he's good. Because I started realizing a lot of these Christian apologists and evangelists, they don't actually preach the Bible. They're heretics. And so I started looking into his ministry, and I'd never heard of Young Earth Creationism in my life. And it really blew me away because I thought, there's so much the Bible speaks about this topic. Like, how have I never even heard of it? And even though Ken Ham's really liberal and I don't actually agree with his ministry or anything, at the time, just the fact that the Bible actually spoke about these topics and the truth from the Bible was just blowing me away. And I saw a comment on YouTube. It said, hey, you need to check out Kent Hovind because he's way better. So I started really getting into Kent Hovind. He was way better. You know, only used the King James Bible. Was a much more intelligent person.
Mm-hmm.
I ended up watching like every single one of his videos. And that's where I really made the transition where I changed a lot of my viewpoints on doctrine. I became King James only through this time because I'd been using an ESV Bible for that Bible study group that mm-hmm. I was doing with the kids. And I had written this sermon and I had made this really good point. And as I was using like some other version to prepare my sermon, but then when we were in the group and we were using the ESV, it said something completely different. It was gone. Like, the whole point I was trying to make didn't even exist in that version. And so mm-hmm. it kind of blew me away. I was thinking, like, what's wrong with this ESV Bible?
It's so different.
So I was pretty, you know, open to the idea of, like, what's going on with these Bibles. And as soon as I saw, like, Ken Hovind say, I only use the King James Bible because the other ones have errors. I mean, I immediately was like, yeah, it's obviously the King James Bible. Because these other Bibles are saying, like, Elhanan, the son of Jehoiakim, slew Goliath. And they're saying they have all these contradictions within themselves. And I just was, like, immediate King James only. So from that point, I started researching just the King James only position. Because the thing that surprised me is whenever I would approach family members or friends about that viewpoint, that they just didn't even care. Or they just thought it didn't even matter. And it really kind of blew me away, their apathy. So I was trying to figure out, like, what's the best way to explain it and, like, what's all the arguments. And I started listening to a lot of Sam Gipp and James White. Because they kind of seemed to be the only two people online that I could find that were really, like, diametrically opposed, you know, really researching the topic. And, you know, I don't agree with Sam Gipp. He's obviously a devil, you know.
Looking, hey, our movie came out in 2014.
Yeah, the New World Order Bible versions.
You didn't find it, huh?
I hadn't found it. I couldn't find it.
So how did you find our stuff?
Well, it was through James White. Because he had made a response video to Sam Gipp, like saying the King James Bible's archaic and, you know, there's all these words that we don't know. Like, he would say a doe.
Right.
As opposed to a dude.
Choler.
Exactly. So I found a video by this guy saying response to James White's response to Sam Gipp or whatever, and it was you.
Uh-huh.
And you, like, were pointing out how he's just mispronouncing all these common words. And then he was attacking the fact that he's saying the King James Bible was, like, Middle English or something.
Yeah.
And so you quote, like, Beowulf.
For Old English.
Yeah, for Old English.
Yeah, because Chaucer is Middle English, and Beowulf is Old English. And he was saying, like, it's Old English or Middle English, and I was explaining how the King James is actually Modern English.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So it really blew me away that you had, like, quoted this, like, old, you know, passage from Beowulf. So I just started listening to some of your sermons, and I mean, it really blew me away because I'd never heard anybody preach so much Bible. And that was what I was seeking for so much. Mm. Me and my wife, we were trying to get involved in life groups for several years. And we'd always go to these groups, but they never opened the Bible. Mm. I mean, they're using other books that were about the Bible or just things about topics like marriage or raising a family would be the group's focus. Mm. It was never opening the Bible. And I kept saying, like, we would try group after group after group. Some groups, they would just watch a video. Some groups would only fellowship.
And you were hungry
fellowship.
For the Word of God.
So I was like, I'm going to find the most hardcore, like, Bible study group. And they had the, like, second main pastor of this, like, 10,000-person church had a Men of the Word group. Mm. So I'm going to, and they would do line by line, supposedly, through the Bible.
That sounded great.
Yeah, but they would use, everybody used every other version. So somebody's using the NASB, somebody's using the ESV, somebody's using the Amplified. So it was like this mad gab. Mm-hmm. That we would go through, and I wasn't learning anything. It was really frustrating still. And I approached the guy, and I said, hey, what do you think about the King James only position? You know, the fact that the King James is the only Bible. He's like, I've never heard of that. And I was like, it already was really frustrating me because I thought, you've committed your whole life to serving God and like studying the Bible, and you're not even aware that people have different viewpoints on the different versions. That really kind of like... I thought I would have more respect for a guy that at least had a viewpoint towards mm-hmm. the King James position rather than just being ignorant of that right. position. And so I kind of explained the King James position to this guy, and he says, that's the most ignorant and foolish thing that I've ever heard.
Wow.
And at that point, our conversation just kind of was like, you know, I don't know what to say to this guy. You know, I was giving him a ride to lunch, and I was just like, all right, get out, you know. And then I never went back. And so I was just trying to, you know, find truth, just trying to seek more things, and I had changed my viewpoint on a lot of doctrines at that point. And I had kind of been convinced that my church was right on the gospel because they gave lip service to it. They would say, you know, it's just by faith, it's a one-time event, you can't lose your salvation. But at the same time, they would say, well, if you're practicing sin, though, did you really believe?
Right.
And so they had all these caveats for lordship, salvation, all those type of things. But I think it's still possible for people to get saved in these liberal churches, but just not through the leadership.
Yeah, just through the right worker. Because, you know, even in a super liberal church, the pastor might not even be saved. Some of the members could be saved. Because
exactly.
I know, like, when we were Independent Fundamental Baptists, when our church went bad when I was a kid, it was like everybody went over to the Fun Center Church. So they were from an Independent Fundamental Baptist church, but when that church fell apart, a lot of them just ended up going to the liberal church. So there are saved people in these fun centers. Because when you go soul winning, you'll run into people who go to these fun centers that give all the right answers on the gospel. But then when you talk to them, usually they're like, oh, I used to be Baptist, or I was at a Baptist summer camp, or they'll quote you the verses from the King James of how they got saved, but then now they're at some super liberal fun center. So yeah, you can get saved if you have the right person dealing with you, if you have the right Sunday school teacher, altar worker, or whatever, right?
Exactly. I mean, it really kind of, in hindsight, things just, you know, I kept opening my eyes, it's like the scales are falling from my eyes, as it were, about a lot of things that I was raised. And my family really didn't agree. My family, you know, wholeheartedly thought I was, you know, going off the deep end and kind of apostatizing, as it were. I'm the apostate of the family, as it were.
Do they still kind of feel that way?
Yeah, I mean, my whole family, you know, when I talk to them, they're like, hey, you realize you're starting a cult. You realize that you're in a cult.
That's what they said about the church is starting in Houston?
Exactly. I even told my dad, I said, you know, when I was talking to my sister, you know, this week, she was like, you realize that the whole family thinks you're in a cult, John. And I said, you know, and she says, I'm starting a cult. And my dad's like, so what's the name of it? I was like,
he's trying to be all friendly about it.
Yeah.
And like, so what's the name of the cult you're starting, Jonathan?
Yeah. You know, they have this viewpoint that their viewpoint is like the world opinion. They don't even realize that even though a lot of their opinions are minor opinions or not even what main Christianity even believes, but because they go to this big church, they're convinced that that's what everybody
believes.
That's
how everybody feels.
Exactly. Even though in that church, there's no unity.
Now, is this that same church where they were playing Rob Bell videos in the youth group back in the day?
Yeah. I mean, even in the main sanctuary, this is crazy. In the summer, they would have like a mass exodus. Nobody's coming to church. Mm. So in order to try and bring people in, they started doing Hollywood movies for the services.
Wow.
Like, At first, I thought they were doing Christian movies.
Like, what were some of the movies that they played?
They did Iron Man, Despicable Me, Captain Phillips. And, you know, they would run it because they wouldn't even just show the movie. They would just show, like, clips. And then they would try to do, like, a little bit of a Bible lesson from the movie in the middle. So they just ruined it for everybody. Like, the people that want to learn the Bible, they have to go to this Hollywood movie.
And the people that want to see the movie have to get the Bible.
They had to get all this commentary and stuff. They'd have popcorn. They had these movie posters with all the celebrities, and you put your head, you know, like, and take pictures and do all this stuff. I was against it. Like, even though I went to this liberal church, I thought it was wicked. And I, like, was condemned by my whole family because I was like, I'm not going to go. And what they're doing is wrong. And I said, if they want to have movies at church, you know, a Christian movie on, the like, Friday, whatever. But to replace the preaching, to replace the sermon with a movie.
With just a secular Hollywood
movie. And, like,
movie?
A secular Hollywood movie? I mean, some of these Hollywood actors are known sodomites and just, like, you know, some of the worst filth people, and they're liking them unto Christ. You know, they're Playboy, Iron Man, or whatever. This guy's like a womanizer.
I never seen it.
So it was just a weird experience to try and, you know, go through this and realize that everything I was raised was wrong.
So once you got online and you started learning more, you're King James only, you're listening to a lot of hard preaching, so you ended up switching to a Baptist church in your area, right?
Yeah, so once I kind of realized that my church, I didn't agree with my church on anything anymore, we just stopped going. And, you know, I was listening to pretty much only your sermons and some other things online, and I knew I needed to get into a good church. Mm. My wife, since she was raised Southern Baptist, that was kind of where we were defaulting. Mm. Like, maybe we should go to a Southern Baptist church.
Right.
And for about 6 months or so, we were kind of just church hopping. And after listening to more of your preaching, I was realizing there was a difference between a Southern Baptist church and an Independent Baptist church. Mm. So I was wanting to try the Independent Baptist churches in our area. So we tried this one Independent Baptist church. My wife was like, let's go. Let's try it. So I called the pastor. We spoke on the phone. It sounded good. You know, he's like, they said they did soul winning. They were King James only. And we show up, and, like, everybody at the church knows us by name when we walk in. It was kind of, like, awkward. Like,
how
we walk in.
You?
Like, I never introduced myself. I walk in, they're like, you must be Jonathan and Carrie Shelley.
Oh, because you called.
Yeah.
So they were just so excited, like, somebody called. Yeah. Somebody's interested.
Yeah.
That's funny.
And it was like, it really, you know, was off-putting to my wife. She's like, how do these people know our name? And, like, it was super weird.
You, like, know who your kids are.
Yeah, and funny. The choir, they had all the programs, even though the church only had, like, 20 people. So,
oh, wow.
Like, whenever they had choir, everybody's in the choir, and they're just, like, singing to us. And it was super awkward. We had a Sunday school, and it was just like 3 or 4 people.
Hey, some people might actually love all that attention.
Yeah, I don't know.
If somebody's really lonely, you should give them the name of that church. It'll be like, so-and-so, we've been waiting for you.
Well, and I thought the guy was right on salvation. I didn't really question him on it. But we get up in the sermon. It was pre-trib. Mm. And then he just rips on repent of your sins. And I was just like, this is not, you know.
Yeah.
My wife was, like, so relieved because she was just like,
she didn't really like it.
Yeah, she hated it. So we started going to this, like, big Southern Baptist church, too. We were kind of trying a lot of different churches. And they were real traditional, at least. So it wasn't, like, a fun center necessarily.
Yeah.
But they were very liberal,
it was
obviously
a more conservative of the spectrum of Southern Baptists.
Right. And the church was weird. This one thing, they did baby dedications. And the main pastor, he would take the baby from the parents. And then he would hold the baby up. Like, you know, Lion King or something. And then they would twirl around the baby as they sung to this baby for the baby dedication.
What in the world?
And it just freaked me out. I was thinking, because we were just starting to have kids. And I was like, there is no way that guy is going to lift up my baby and do this, like, twirling thing. And so we were just at a loss. I felt like there was just no good church in our area. I think a lot of people...
I mean, you're in Amarillo. It's kind of a small town, right?
There was like 7 Independent Baptist churches there.
How many people live in Amarillo?
It's about 200,000 people.
Yeah, that's a pretty small town.
It's not like a major city or anything.
I mean, to me, to someone like me, I've only lived in big cities my whole life.
So. Right. So, I mean, it's not like Dallas or it's not like Phoenix or anything like that. But they had 7 Independent Baptist churches, but there was lots of them I wouldn't even try. Like, one was like a total Ruckmanite church. And
yeah, you know,
a lot of things I didn't want to go to. And the one church that I had considered... on their doctrinal statement, they sounded really Calvinist because they're using, like, perseverance of the saints and total depravity in their doctrinal statement. So I just wrote them off. I didn't even call them or try to visit their church. But the Southern Baptist guy, the pastor, I was trying to talk to him about the King James only position. He's like, you should just try this King James only church. And I said, well, aren't they Calvinists? And he's like, I don't think so. So I ended up calling them. I spoke to the youth pastor at that time. And I pretty much got on the phone. I just said, what do you think about Calvinism? And the guy was like, I don't think very much at all. And I was like, so do you believe in the five, you know, points of tulip or whatever? And he was like, no. And he's like, are you just like trolling us? And I was like, no, I read on your doctrinal statement. I was just kind of testing it out. I was interested in visiting your church. And so I ended up going, I ended up becoming pretty good friends with the guy. And it ended up being a really good blessing just to find a church that was at least King James only.
So they weren't Calvinists at all. They just had kind of a weird thing in their doctrinal statement that made it sound that way.
I even asked the pastor about it because you had to do a class to join the church. And he said, well, we don't want to let people reinterpret Bible words. But I was like, well, depravity is not even in the Bible. And, you know, it doesn't use the word perseverance to describe anything about salvation. So
he was obviously just copying and pasting from someone who was more Calvinist than him.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, the guy was, he was a good pet preacher. I liked him, but he ended up retiring. And I had approached him saying, you know, I'm considering, you know, wanting to go into the ministry, wanting to be a pastor. Would you consider training me? And he's like, you know, I honestly, if it was like a year ago you'd approached me with this, I would say wholeheartedly yes. But I'm going to retire, so you need to ask the next guy. Mm-hmm. So the next guy came in pretty quickly, and I ended up approaching him with the same thing a few weeks after he'd been there. I said, hey, you know, I go soul winning on Saturdays. I'd like to start a soul winning, you know, movement in the church. And I'd even like to be a pastor one day. Would you consider training me? And he said, you know, I really encourage people to go to Bible college. That's where they're going to get a lot of hands-on training and experience. I'm kind of a hands-off type of guy. But he's like, at least I'm really good at preaching. He was saying, the one thing I've got is I can really put together a sermon.
So that's like, kind of a prideful thing to say, though?
Or? Yeah, it was a little weird.
It was a little weird,
So he agreed, though. Uh-huh. And I figured he might because in his testimony, he said that his dad was a layman who got saved through door-to-door soul winning, ended up getting into a church, was trained at that church, and was sent out to be a pastor. So I thought, with this guy's history, maybe he'd be sympathetic to you know, training a guy through the local church.
But he wasn't.
Well, it ended up, he agreed, but nothing happened.
Right.
Never talked to me. Every time I'd come into him and say, hey, you know, do you need me to help with anything?
Yeah.
You know, I'll go soul winning on Saturdays. Can we get a soul winning program through the church?
Yeah.
He'd say, well, we don't want to just start a soul winning program and then, like, quit in the winter. People don't like to go to soul winning after work gets dark.
Say he was just making excuses.
Lots of excuses.
That, you know, it's kind of like when I approached my pastor in California about getting trained, he said, oh, yeah, I'm going to train you for the ministry. And he told me all these things that we're going to do, and this is how I'm going to train you. But then it just never happened. You know, years went by. I've got two kids, and I keep asking him, and nothing was happening. So finally, I just bit the bullet and went to Bible college because it was like, I could just tell nothing was going to happen. So you wanted him to train you. He said he's going to do it, but it just, the training never materialized.
Yeah, I mean, right? He never asked me to do anything. The only thing, I decided to start preparing sermons just to be prepared if I ever got an opportunity.
Right.
And I'd actually been blessed enough. One of the guys I knew at my old church, he would volunteer for a recovery and addiction center. Mm-hmm. And they just did preaching every single day. They had like two sermons every single day. They'd have to preach to the people before they could eat. So all these people would show up just because they wanted the food, but they had to endure like a 30 or 40 minute sermon.
Right.
And I was able to preach like every week almost at this chapel service. So I had got a lot of experience preaching already. And I just prepared a sermon like, if I ever get an opportunity to preach in my church, you know, I want to be ready. And one Sunday morning, right after the sermon, the pastor gets up and he goes, all right, for the Sunday evening service, We're gonna have a sermon from Jonathan Shelley. And I was just like, okay. And he's like, but 5 minutes. And it was kind of weird. And I was like, okay. And he picked like two other people. So like he had three of us just give like a 5 minute sermon on a Sunday night. So I just kind of like repurposed my longer sermon into something.
5 minute version.
Yeah, 5 minute version. And it was a great blessing to be able to get to preach. You know, there was hundreds of people that went to that church.
Mm-hmm.
And but after that, still nothing. Just nothing was happening. Nothing was happening. And I kind of already said in my heart that even though I was going to go through the training there, I wanted to come to Faith Word Baptist Church to kind of finish off my training. Because I knew I was already like-minded with Faithward Baptist Church or Verity Baptist Church, and I knew that if I went out to go start a church in the future that I was going to get disowned. Mm-hmm. You know, I'd heard your stories about how Regency Baptist Church, after hearing about the pre-trib, you know, departure, that they were pretty much not going to have anything to do with you. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to at least have some fellowship with people that are like-minded, you know, and train from somebody that actually did some hard preaching. Mm-hmm. You know, the preaching at these churches was just never really on sin. Mm-hmm. It was just the evangelistic-type sermons.
Right.
And they started a sermon series in January, brand new sermon series on the pre-trib rapture.
Oh, man.
And, you know, I had already purposed in my heart, like, I'll endure pre-trib sermons. I'll just be a blessing to this church. It's been great. But he did it, you know, starting January 1st, every single week, just another pre-trib sermon. And we would always read Matthew 24. It was like we couldn't not open to Matthew 24, but we never read verse 29. Never, not one time.
Wow.
And so they would just kind of read like the whole, you know, beginning of woes.
And it's like, hey, let's jump down to verse 36.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Every single time, like clockwork. And then we get rolled into February, and he's like, well, we're going to continue our pre-trib series. I just feel like this is really important. And then we roll into March, and he's like, yeah, we're going to continue our pre-trib series. And I think at this point, I mean, it was just wearing my wife down to like this every degree. And she ended up just saying to me, like, what if we just move early? I mean, it was just like a fresh of breath air to me. I just said, let's do it. So we ended up, you know, deciding, like, let's just put it in action. Let's figure out how we can get to Faithward Baptist Church, you know, as soon as possible. And so I ended up, you know, we had to sell our house. You know, I approached my job.
Now, didn't you tell me that another factor was that the pastor whose greatest strength was preaching, that he actually just started reading his sermons from a paper?
Yes.
Did you tell me that?
So we ended up going to the Steadfast one-year anniversary service, and that was the first time I actually ended up getting to meet you there. And that weekend that we left, the pastor got up in the pulpit, and he addressed the church, and he said, you know, I'm really struggling, and I feel like I can't preach right now, so I'm just going to read my sermons. And he's like, but I hope that y'all can be praying for me and, like, encourage me through this, you know, transition, and I'll get to where I, you know, the better. So we show back up, and we don't even know anything. And all of a sudden, the 30-minute sermon turned into a 15-minute sermon.
Just read from a paper.
And it basically sounded like he took, like, four or five commentaries and just kind of mixed them together and was just reading that to us. And it was so precise that there was a hearing-impaired couple that sat pretty close to us. Mm-hmm. And one of the service weeks, we were sitting just, like, right next to them. And he had this paper, and it was different than the bulletin. And so I looked at it, and it was exactly the sermon from the pastor. And I watched as this guy is following line by line exactly what he was saying.
Because the guy was just reading it.
He was literally reading a sermon in the most literal way that you could possibly say. Just a 15-minute sermon. And we would be done, like, with service just so quick that they had to start pumping up the special music.
And how many people went to this church?
I mean, on a Sunday morning, you might have 400 or 500 people.
So you have 400 or 500 people showing up, and this guy just reads a 15-minute sermon off a paper?
I mean, it blew me away. And, you know, the church attendance didn't even suffer. Because the main pastor, you know, he just put so much honor onto this guy before he left over. He did a really good transition. It made me think of, like,
and this is the new guy.
Yeah.
So how long has he been pastoring?
He had pastored a church in Lubbock.
No. I mean, how long had he been pastoring the new church?
Probably 5 months.
So he'd only been there for 5 months, and then he announces how he's going to transition to just reading?
Exactly.
5 months into his job, and he's already just panicking?
I mean, I don't know what happened.
That's bizarre.
And, you know, the people at that church...
Is he still there?
Yeah. And he's still reading his sermons.
No way.
Because all every once in a while, I'll just go back and look. And we even visited when we went back home. Mm-hmm. We just went to this service. And, yeah, I mean, he looks up a little bit more. But you know, like, that he's just reading.
It's mainly being read.
Yeah. And at most, it's like a 20-minute sermon.
Unbelievable.
You know, and the thing about those churches, they support 150 or 175 missionaries. So they're constantly having people visit because of deputation or...
Oh, so they'll put those people behind the pulpit.
Every single time they show up.
Yeah. Some pastors are like that. They'll just bring in any missionary because it's just an excuse not to preach.
Exactly.
Like, just put somebody else in the pulpit.
I mean, he'd preach only maybe once a week. Yeah. And it'd be that 15... So he had constant, you know, evangelists
constant
and missionaries
through,
and just... His friends would come and preach for him. because they're really plugged into this Bible college, Heartland Baptist Bible College. They're really pushing the Bible college. They constantly had groups come singing for our church. Mm-hmm. We gave them thousands of dollars every year. But, you know, I mean, the church, it was a blessing because we had no church.
Right.
And at least they were right on the gospel. At least I could
invite people to this church. You could go soul winning, go to church.
A lot of good people in the church.
Or did you say, was there soul winning?
Well, they had members that would go soul winning.
Oh, okay.
But they
didn't have an official program.
They had had some in the past. And when I talked to the older pastor, the person that had been there before, he said, yeah, we have soul winning programs, and they usually just kind of die in the winter, and then we just kind of pick them back up again. Mm-hmm. And so, but he's like, but eventually got to the point where it was just me going, and so, you know, we just kind of stopped. And he's like, every once in a while I get convicted enough to just go out there and preach the gospel to somebody. But, you know, you could tell it was from the pulpit, because they would preach these pretty good sermons that would lead up to, like, a plug for the soul winning time, but since they had no program, you know, it was just kind of like really no application.
There was no call to action. So you ended up moving to Faithful Word.
Yeah, I ended up in the end of May, we ended up moving here, 2016. So a little over 2 years ago, we made the trek. And, you know, we bought a house online. I'd never visited Phoenix any time in my life before. I'd never spoken to you except for just that one time in Old Pass.
Wasn't it like at a park that I met you? It was like after soul winning, all the soul winners met at a park to like, I don't know if it was like to eat lunch or something, right? Didn't we have lunch at a park, like Panda Express?
It was Panda Express.
Isn't that where I met you?
Yeah, so I met you that one time at Donnie Romero's opening service, but then I also went to Old Pass First Church service.
Oh, maybe that's what I'm thinking of.
And so after the first push for soul winning, we went to some park and we had lunch.
Oh, okay.
And so I ended up getting to talk to you. And I told you, like, hey, I'm planning on moving to Faith Word Baptist Church, going to Phoenix. And you were just kind of like, cool.
Well, because I hear that. I hear that all the time. So it's just kind of like, okay.
You're pretty nonchalant about it. And I was like, he must get, like, people say this all the time or something.
It wasn't like somebody calls our church one time and it's like, you must be Jonathan.
Right, yeah. Well, every time I called, I only got to speak to Tyler Baker. You know, and he told me, he told me all kinds of weird stuff. I asked him, like, hey, I'm trying to buy this house. You know, is there a good area or a bad area to buy in? He's like, every area is the same. You know, there's no bad area in Phoenix. It's all exactly the same. And I was just kind of like, how in a city of 4 million people is like every neighborhood the exact same?
Yeah, that's
and
not
just
true
like,
at all.
I mean, it really kind of blew me away. So I bought this house and I was like, we're just going to make it work. And so we ended up moving out here, and I mean, everything was great. Mm. Everything worked out, you know. It was kind of like, it just felt like God's hand was on it because, you know, we sold our house without even showing it. Mm-hmm. I was kind of nervous because I had tore out the entire bathroom of our house. It was just gutted, and I was going to redo it, and I told somebody I was moving, and he's like, I know a guy that wants to buy your house. And I said, okay. And so I just called the guy up. He's like, yeah. He comes over, he looks at the house, and I kind of gave him a price, and he was like, let's do it. And he's like, and don't finish the bathroom. I want to do it.
Wow, so, that's great.
I mean, no inspection. It was a cash deal.
So God was just blessing you.
I was just like, he just said, set the date. And I was like, okay. So we just set the date. We moved.
Awesome.
It was like the smoothest transition. And we came out here, and really, it was just a great blessing. I approached you like, I think either the first weekend or the second weekend, and I said that I wanted to train to be a pastor. And you said, what's your timeline? And I said, 2 years. And you're like, if you prepare yourself and you meet all the qualifications, I'll send you out in 2 years. And so, you know, and there's so much opportunity at Faith Word Baptist Church that anybody that just wants to, I mean, they're going to be able to serve the Lord in a lot of great ways.
Yeah,
so,
you got a lot of training in 2 years.
Yeah, I mean, there was more stuff I could have done if I had, you know, had more time or more ability or energy. And so, you know, it's been a great blessing to be here. I changed my whole life, really. And, you know, it gave me a lot of perspective because my wife, she was kind of more of a godly person than I was growing up. She was a good example to me in a lot of things. But as I was kind of going through this transition, I kind of got to turn the tables on her just a little bit to where I was trying to, you know, seek the Lord and do these things. And we were kind of edifying one another.
You kind of came into your role as a spiritual leader. Is what you're saying.
I feel like she saved me, you know, from just driving off the cliff.
Yeah.
And then I was, you know, able to kind of bolster both of us on tightening
up. Take her to the next level.
Yeah, you know, we kind of edify one another. And so
that's kind of like the opposite with me and my wife, because, like, you know, she was obviously unsaved. I won her to Christ, but then she's actually shown me some things over the years and taught me some things over the years, you know.
But now we get the opportunity to go to Houston. I'm really excited about this opportunity. I visited Houston a few different times, and so I really like the area. My wife, she had told me when we were raised, she was like, I'll never leave Texas. She said, I will never move away from Texas. So just even getting her to Phoenix, Arizona was, you know, a task in and of itself.
Well, I guess that makes sense why when I was kind of suggesting to maybe think about other places than Houston, she was just kind of like really dead set on Houston. Remember, I was kind of bringing up places in California and everything, and I could just tell by her face, she's just like, no way.
In her mind, there was no option. I mean, she was like, her heart was in Houston.
What? People who are from Texas, because you're from, you know, Texas too. People who are from Texas, they just have this thing about just Texas.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
It's they like, have a lot of Texas pride.
Yeah.
Oh, man. They think Texas is the greatest place on the planet. Like, Texas is its own country, as it were. You know?
I don't know what all the hype's about. But, yeah, people who live in Texas are pretty into it, though.
I would say that I had a little bit of that in me.
Yeah, but she had even more.
Yeah, but even moving to Arizona, you know, there's a lot of things I like about Arizona better than Texas.
Yeah.
You know, the constitutional carry, and I love the weather here. I think the weather's great, so I've really enjoyed being in Phoenix. I would think that if you weren't here, it would be one of my top areas to go and start a church. So I can see why you really like this
why
area.
I picked it.
Yeah, and I mean, it's obviously an underreached area. That
so what's your vision for Houston? You know, what's your biggest goal, or what do you kind of, I'm sure you kind of think about what you'd like to see happen, right?
I think just the immediate goal is to just make a plan to actually reach the entire city with the gospel. Mm-hmm. One of the reasons why I picked that area is I had taken a lot of the church information I could find online about what independent Baptist churches were in that area, and I put them on a map. Mm-hmm. And then I kind of just was looking for areas that were underserved, and then I was just even looking for churches that were doing soul winning. I couldn't find any. And, you know, hopefully, you know, in the next decade or so, a lot of more churches will get on fire. But in my opinion, every independent Baptist church should be trying to reach their entire city with the gospel
Amen.
Every year.
Yeah.
And so
the entire county.
Yeah. I mean, why not? And so my vision is going to be, you know, the primary vision is getting Houston the gospel.
So you got to get some soul winners in your church, get them trained, get the soul winning time set up, get the maps going, get the manpower. Because, I mean, a city like Houston with millions and millions of people, you're going to need a huge army of soul winners. You're going to need hundreds of soul winners to get it done.
Exactly. I mean, the key to getting everything done is having the manpower, mm-hmm. is having the soul winners. You can't do it by yourself.
No way.
You can't reach that many people.
It's like a drop of water on a hot stove.
Exactly. It's not as important for me to, you know, soul win with all my time rather than to try and get people zealous for the Lord.
Yeah, you got to have a team.
Exactly. So I think, you know, hopefully...
But it's important as a pastor to get out there and do a lot of soul winning, because that's what's going to inspire other people. You got to model the way.
Exactly.
Lead the way by showing the soul winning yourself.
Being a good example. Mm-hmm. And I'm hoping that if we can train a soul winning army for Houston, then we can kind of, you know, be a mobile unit. Then mm-hmm. we can start reaching other areas,
small towns,
reaching other countries,
yeah.
reaching these other places. And so, you know, my vision is just to try and reach our immediate area and try to bring in as many soul winners and try to train people to be soul, to do the soul winning.
Yeah.
And then start reaching other areas. And the thing about Houston that's very interesting is it's a highly segregated city.
Really?
So there's just these pockets of people that are demographically completely different. And there's one area of Houston that's like only Spanish speaking. So there's just this huge area where it's only Spanish, every sign's in Spanish.
So it's like a little Mexico to reach right there.
Exactly. You know, my goal would be if I end up having the right guy or have people that are real zealous that want to reach that community, just plant a church like the Faithful Word North. I think it's been a good example of starting a church like that or a ministry like that. And so having a guy over there and just have a Spanish service, like it's Spanish service all 3 weeks.
Yeah.
You know, and so I don't think there's very many zealous independent Baptist churches that are having Spanish services only in America. And there's, I think, 2 million people in the Houston metro that are Spanish-speaking.
Wow.
So that's a really underserviced area that's not getting good doctor.
Now, you just started learning Spanish, what, about 9 months ago or something?
Yeah, I mean, I had taken Spanish classes in high school.
But you got serious about it about 9 months ago, right?
Yeah, I could say hola and things like that.
No, but I mean, you picked it up pretty fast, though.
Yeah.
Because I think you told me you spent about 6 months studying, and then you came with us on the Mexico missions trip, where we don't allow any English. So even at the restaurant, right, all the fellowship was in Spanish, on the drive. So you were basically just immersed in Spanish for 3 days. And I think you were probably the most beginner on the whole trip, as far as your Spanish was the most rudimentary. But you were able to hang with us for 3 days. And didn't you win somebody to the Lord?
Yeah, I ended up being able to actually win 4 people to the Lord.
Down in Mexico?
Trip. Yes, sir. Those were the first people I'd ever won to the Lord.
And those people down there don't speak English at all. So
no.
It was all Spanish.
It was totally Spanish. I didn't.
Yeah.
I might have accidentally slipped an English word.
So how did you learn Spanish so well so fast? Because it was about 6 months of intensive study. What did you do?
Well, I mean, you really inspired me with the Duolingo stuff that you.
So was Duolingo your main thing?
Yeah, I would say that was probably the main thing.
Well, it shows that Duolingo works, man.
Yeah, I mean, it's really diverse as far as all the different aspects that it kind of reaches you in, mm-hmm. all the different categories.
It covers a lot of grammar, covers a lot of subject matter.
Yeah. Exactly. So, and then I was also just studying the how to present the gospel. So I was reading the Reign of Aragomas 10, and I kind of put together a vocabulary list.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just doing study, you know, 15, 20 minutes.
You probably listened to, like, Brother Jimenez's gospel presentation in Spanish.
I even found a couple other guys that were giving gospel presentation. I just kind of listened to it, or
yeah.
I would listen to stuff while I was working. And so mm-hmm. I think just the key to learning foreign language is just keeping the momentum.
Mm-hmm.
Because it seems like when you're learning, you just keep making, you know, new going to the next level just constantly,
just
as long
stay
as you're
motivated.
Steadfast.
Yeah, just keep doing it.
And just trying to talk to people.
Did you talk to people at Faithful Word to practice as well? Or?
Yeah, every service, there's people in our church that speak fluently, and so I would just try to go up to them, and I have the same conversation with every single person, but at least it was kind of giving me
the
framework.
You know. Yeah.
Exactly. And so I think the key is just to do it every single day, if you're really serious about it, and just forcing yourself to have conversation.
Right.
Because that's where it really, imprints into your mind.
Yeah.
And kind of, you know, gets certain phrases and certain things and conversational pieces. And you'll start remembering things that you didn't even know that you had back.
Yeah, because the Duolingo is great, but you have to then transfer the theory and into the practical of actually using what you've learned. So I think that's the two-pronged approach. You do the Duolingo every day, and then you talk to the natives with whatever you know. Even if it's just the same conversation with 5 people, it really helps.
Exactly. And, you know, one of the things I even did that they don't necessarily say, but every single phrase that came on the Duolingo app, I would just say out loud.
Mm-hmm.
So even though it might not be one of the questions is one where I have to speak into it.
Right.
I was just saying it with them.
So whether that was the activity or not, you would just do it out loud.
Yeah.
That's like when I read the Bible in Spanish, I read it out loud. Because it's just something about the words coming off your tongue. It really helps.
Exactly.
Well, that's going to help out a lot in Houston. If you need to keep that going.
Yeah, and that was really my primary motivation, is I just knew there was so many Spanish-speaking
people. Wait,
so
it wasn't the tacos? I thought your primary motivation was to come on my trip and eat tacos.
Yeah, I kind of like Tex-Mex, but, you know. No, the tacos were really good.
Tex-Mex.
And those onions, the cebollas, they were really good. So
yeah, those are good.
I really enjoyed that trip. I want to go back.
Yeah.
So, you know.
Well, we're going back in November.
I know. I might have to make a trip with you.
Peel
guys.
Yourself away from Houston.
But. Yeah, invite some of the guys there that speak Spanish to come with me.
Yeah.
So I'm really excited about the opportunity there. That was my main motivation to trying to relearn Spanish,
mm-hmm.
was just the fact that Houston had so many Spanish speakers.
Yeah.
And when you announced that trip was going to happen in January, I said, you know, I need to go on that trip. Because if I don't go on that trip, you know, I'm going to waste the opportunity to really immerse myself
mm-hmm.
and make a really big gain.
Yeah.
I don't know how long it would take me to actually win somebody to the Lord if I had never gone on that trip.
Right.
And so even
Well,
I
but
was
mainly
basic,
what the trip provides is like a motivation, too. Because it's like a deadline.
Yeah.
Like, I got to turn my tree gold by that time.
Right.
Well, it's great talking to you, Brother Shelley, and I'm looking forward to seeing what God does in Houston.
Yeah, I really appreciate the conversation and everything that you've done for me. So I feel like it's just been a great blessing, and I'm really excited about the opportunity that I have, you know, before me.